psychological character set developed from the adults. Now, the early results were published in Brown and Freitas in 1994, and this paper summarized the information known from the immatures and presented a very useful list of characters that can be applied to immature larvae within the group. And then, together with Keith Wilmont, they combined two independent morphological data sets. And Keith Wilmont's data set focused primarily on adults, while Andre Freitas' work focused mostly on the immatures. And the work from this is presented here, where we have, on the left, we have the adults, and then on the right, we have the immatures. And here, they actually were able to sample almost 80% of all known species in the Athomyines, which is a very impressive taxonomic data set. And it included over 105 species, 353 morphological characters, 75 from the immatures, and 278 from the adults. The taxa were selected to represent all described genera with large, then increased sampling within the large and diversified genera to sample most of the important species groups. Now, in this case, the separate analysis resulted in equivalent trees in terms of resolution, but both they varied from the combined analysis that is shown here. Now, don't worry about the names, but the one thing I really want to point out here is these little black caterpillars that are mapped onto the tree. These nodes, there's 21 of them, are marked with the small caterpillar, and they had immature stage partition Bremer supports, which were higher than expected, given the ratio of immature characters to adult characters. Because you remember, we have only 75 immature characters, whereas we have 278 adult characters. So you would normally expect that the adult characters would swamp the contribution of these larval immature, these immature characters within the phylogeny. But that apparently isn't the case. We actually have found, they demonstrated that with this partition Bremer support, that the ratio of immature to adult characters is much higher than expected. And simple inspection and statistical simulation showed that these nodes tended to be more basal than expected by chance. And so the majority of the information the larval characters are contributing actually exists at the base of the tree, which is often where finding resolution within these groups can be quite difficult. So despite the comparatively few characters from the immatures, there's two lines of evidence that suggest that they are especially important in resolving the more basal nodes. First, these combined results, and separate analyses show that there's greater differences in the basal nodes, and the partition Bremer support analysis suggests that the basal nodes tend to be more strongly supported by immature stages than expected. So the next step in this work was to, of course, combine with the molecular data to see whether there is congruence between the morphological and molecular data sets. And this will be conducted with collaboration with Dr. Andy Brower, and then Andreas is hoping to focus on the description of immatures from key genera and species, but this will completely depend on whether on larval collection and sampling. So overall, the main take-home message from this is that immatures and adults may be telling us different parts of the same story, and rather than being additive only, they are complementary data sets. And neither partition by itself is better to propose a phylogenetic hypothesis, but by combining these two data sets, we can get better resolution of the whole picture. And that the time and expense in obtaining life history information is likely to be repaid in full in phylogenetic studies, and that is concluded by the two examples presented here. And that is it. Thank you very much.
In Europe, this is the distribution as of 2006. The red areas represent areas where the species was present, and then there's a few little blue spots where it had been present, but it's thought to have been eradicated. Now, the most striking feature is this large area in the sort of central and southeastern part of Europe, and that really originates from the first observed introduction of the species just outside Belgrade in 1992, and since then that population appears to have grown and spread out year on year. But we also have all these more disconnected outbreaks in Western Europe. We have ones in the north of Italy, in Switzerland, some in the Low Countries, quite a few in France, and no, it's not really terribly visible on this map, but there is also one just outside of London. So what we'd like to know about these populations is essentially the most probable source-destination relationships between them and also with North America. So there's a couple of cartoon source-destination relationships. So on the right there is two populations being founded from independent introductions out of that blue population. And then we have, on the other side, a more sequential process where the blue population founds the green population, and then the green population goes on and founds the red one. Now, not only would we like to know what is our most probable inferred source-destination relationships, but we'd like to know how confident we are that those inferred relationships reflect the real historical reality. So that's what we want to know. What we do know in terms of data we have available, well, we have genetic data in terms of microsatellite data, both for North America as collected by Tom and Kyung-seok, and we also have data using those same microsatellite markers for the populations in Europe. Something to keep in mind when we're talking about genetic variation and these introductions is that it's very likely that when a new population is introduced, there's going to be a founder effect and a sort of bottleneck because it's a small number of individuals being introduced into that new location. So essentially what's happening is a small sample of the genetic variation in the source population is being taken and transplanted somewhere else. So that immediately starts to give us some signal because, well, to give a crude example, if we have a destination population, an outbreak that we're looking at, and a putative source, and we see alleles in our outbreak that we don't see in that putative source, we can then discount that putative source. So as well as genetic data, we have information from the monitoring effort that goes on in Europe. There's a fairly comprehensive program within the European countries to keep track of where this species is showing up. So we have fairly accurate information on exactly where these outbreaks are popping up and also what year they were detected in. So that starts to give us some signal about the sequence of events. So these are the samples that we looked at that are already published, the results are already published for. So we have samples from this big main central southeastern Europe region. Those samples all turn out to be pretty genetically homogeneous, and we can consider that that is a single population that's spread out from that initial introduction. We also have two outbreaks from Italy, one in the northeast and one in the northwest, and we have three outbreaks from France, one in the Alsace region in the east of the country, and two outbreaks from around Paris. One was detected in 2002, and then there was a second outbreak detected a few miles north some 2 years later. So we have genetic information about these samples. We know when they were first detected and so on. And what we'd like to do is integrate that information together and try and get our best idea of the introduction routes. And the way we go about that is by approximate Bayesian computation, or ABC, which is quite a mouthful, and the implementation can get a bit fiddly, but the basic idea behind it is pretty straightforward, and it's one of inference by simulation. So the first step is to develop models of the introduction history, and these are sort of demographic genetic models modeling how changes in population size, different sequences of introduction events, will impact genetic variation. Now, as with all models, these models have parameters. And in our case, very often the real values for those parameters are more or less unknown. So what we do is we draw values from uninformative flat prior distributions. So to give you an example of what I mean by that, the number of founders involved in starting a new outbreak, well, we really don't know much about that number, but we know it's got to be at least two individuals, and we can say it's unreasonable to suppose that it's going to exceed 1,000. So what we do when we run a simulation, that number of founders, we draw it as a random number somewhere between 2 and 1,000. So what we then do is we run these simulations millions of times. And each time we run a simulation, we can summarize the properties of that genetic data we're generating in terms of a number of statistics. These are things, for example, how divergent are different populations, how much diversity do we lose during an introduction, and so on. What we can then do is we can calculate those same statistics for our observed data and see how similar the two are. And we can then retain those cases where the simulated data is very like the real data, and we can use those retained cases to estimate the posterior distributions of these parameters. The logic being that if we had a simulation that generated genetic data that's very like the real thing, it's likely that the parameters in play during that simulation are also very like the ones that were operating in reality. So just to give a quick example of sort of some of the demographic parameters in these models, this is a really rather simple model of the demography of an introduction. So it starts out with a small number of founders being introduced into the new location, and then there's a sort of lag period where the population stays small for a number of generations, and it then increases up to some much larger stable population size. So we have these two demographic parameters, the number of founders and the stable population size. And we also have these kind of two time parameters in here. We have the duration of this bottleneck period where the population is small, and we also have this time lag between the population being introduced and the outbreak being detected. And it's here that some of this monitoring information can start to feed in, because it gives us essentially a sort of natural ceiling on the priors for these time parameters. Clearly, we can't detect a population until it's been introduced, and we might also make the assumption that if a population has got up to this large stable population size, it must get detected at least by them. So those are the demographic parameters. There's also some fairly uninteresting genetic parameters like mutation rates in these models. The thing we're really interested in is this sequence of introduction events. To keep things manageable, we handled this in terms of triplets of populations, because that then limits the number of possible introduction sequences there can be. So in any given triplet, one member is always North America, because ultimately that's our ancestral population. We then have two European populations, let's call them I and J, and I is the population that was detected first, and J is the population that was detected second. So here we have a case of a successive introduction. So there's an introduction out of North America that founds population I, and then sometime later there's an introduction out of population I that founds population J. Now, because there's this degree of uncertainty about the lag between introduction and detection, we also have to consider the time-reversed case, where we have an introduction from North America into J, and then an introduction from J into I, even though we detected I earlier on. So our second main class of scenario or sequence is independent introductions. So here we have an introduction from North America into I, and then at some time later we have a second separate introduction from North America founding J. And as with the successive sequence, we also have to consider the time-inversed version. One thing we do have to be a bit careful about is not overestimating the number of transatlantic introductions. And we could end up doing that if we don't take into account a third possible introduction sequence, which we ended up referring to as ghost populations. So the idea here is we have an unknown European population. It may be unknown because it's not been detected, or at least not sampled, or it may actually be one of the populations in our sample, but just not considered in this current triplet. In any event, the idea is we have a single transatlantic introduction going from North America to found the ghost population, and we then have two independent intra-European introductions, founding I and then J. And as always, we have to consider the opposite time sequence as well. So in order to determine the introduction history of any given outbreak, what we do is we consider all the triplets involving that outbreak, and we can then piece together the overall introduction history, and we can get an idea of how confident we are of that in a couple of ways. One way is to treat these introduction sequences as a parameter of the model and give them a flat prior. So all six of those sequences we treat as a priori equally likely, and we can estimate the posterior density for those. Or we can treat them as models in their own right and compare them by means of Bayes factors, and there's conventions for how big a Bayes factor needs to get before we consider there's some real statistical support there. So when we do that, here's what we find as the history for those samples I showed you earlier. So we have the initial original introduction from North America into Serbia. You then have that expansion out, and at some point later you then have an intra-European successive introduction from that population founding the outbreak in northeast Italy. However, northwest Italy is due to a completely separate transatlantic introduction, as is the outbreak that was detected outside Paris in 2002. And that Paris outbreak then went on and acted as the source for an intra-European introduction into Alsace. Now, there's no arrow associated with the 2004 Paris outbreak because we didn't have solid statistical support for any particular introduction scenario. So that's as far as we've got in terms of things that are published, but we, subsequent to this being published, we continue to acquire samples from around Europe, and a little before I left France, we had a master's student come in and start working with some of this stuff, and he's now going on and he's working towards his PhD, and he's just finished looking at some of these extra samples. So the extra samples, with including Italy and just poking over the border into Switzerland there, and the reason that's interesting is that it doesn't show up on this map, but the pattern here is fairly patchy. There's gaps between the outbreaks in there, so we want to be sure that this is really a single introduction into that whole region and there aren't other things coming in from other places as well. So we also have a sample from this population just outside of London, and in addition to that, we had some difficulties with that Paris 2002 sample because it was a very small sample. Now, Mark has managed to get hold of some extra individuals for that sample and beef that up a bit. And we also had some trouble with the Alsace sample because it was done early on and the genotyping methodology we were using wasn't terribly robust, and we ended up with quite a bit of missing data. Now Mark's gone back and he's regenotyped that, and he's managed to flesh out those missing data. So what I'm about to show you is his inferred introduction routes, and I should stress these are a little bit tentative because they haven't gone through this approximate Bayesian computation process. It's just a case of Mark eyeballing summary statistics and so on and inferring by eye essentially the most likely introduction routes. We don't have any measure of how confident we are in these introduction routes. Nevertheless, here's what he gets, and the plot thickens somewhat. So we still have the introduction into Serbia and then that successive introduction into northeast Italy. In northwest Italy there, it does in fact look like that is one single growing population derived from a single introduction event. The Paris 2002 outbreak's kind of interesting. We had that as a direct transatlantic introduction, and in the context of the samples we looked at, we weren't strictly speaking wrong, but we did kind of miss a step. It looks like the transatlantic part of this introduction was into the population outside London, and then that went on and founded the Paris 2002 outbreak via an intra-European introduction. As we've fleshed out the data a bit, it now looks like that Paris 2004 outbreak may in fact possibly be another transatlantic introduction, And indeed, the outbreak in Alsace is starting to look more like another independent transatlantic introduction. So I guess the overall story here is that we do have appreciable amounts of movement of this beast in Europe, but it's still the case that these ongoing transatlantic introductions are playing an important part in the distribution of this species within Europe. So that brings us pretty much up to date on what we know about these introduction routes. And I'll just make a few acknowledgements. I now work for Tom, but before I did, he and Kyung Seok were very kind in sending us their microsat data for North America. And Kyung Seok developed all these microsatellites in the first place, which was no small task. When I was working in France, I was working for INRA, and they funded this work. My boss there was Thomas Guillemot, a very smart guy, and I learned a lot working with him. And Mark is the now PhD student working with Thomas and carrying on looking at these introduction routes. Arnaud Estoupe and Jean-Marie Cornouet pretty much developed the ABC methodology and developed the software to carry out those analyses. And then there's quite